I have
current geek.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Current Geek. This is the Current Geek Film Festival, a special monthly look at the greatest movies of all time from a geeky perspective. Our monthly look at the best film ever, best films ever, continues this time North by Northwest. I'm Scott Johnson. He's Tom Merritt. Hi, Tom Merritt.
I am. And you know what? I actually have this with me now.
Yeah.
This is the syllabus from my film class in the fall semester of 1991.
Oh, my gosh.
And North by Northwest was one of the movies that we watched in that film class. I had seen it before.
Yeah.
I appreciated it much more after watching it as part of this film class. And I've seen it many times since. It's definitely one of my favorite movies.
I had never seen it, not even once, till now. And I paid my $3.99 like a good boy and downloaded it from Amazon Prime Video Service. This is where I got it. And I watched it. And I'm happy to report, weirdly and completely outside of my expectations, I liked this the most of anything we've seen so far. Let me clarify that. I liked it more than anything that was made before 1990. Let's say that. So this is 1959.
We haven't watched anything. When you said anything we've seen so far, I assumed you meant as part of the current Geek Film Fest.
Yeah, and that's what I mean too.
Haven't watched anything. Well, Schindler's List was 93.
There's the one.
So that's the most recent one we watched.
That's the rub. I think that's a better movie than anything we've seen. But I also think that I'm biased and lean toward, well, that's newer. It's more, has more modern sensibilities. And is less of a...
Which is odd because it's set in the 40s and in black and white.
Exactly.
But it's North by Northwest set in the 50s because that's when it was made, 1959, and in color.
Right. That's a very good point. However, I can say this with 100% assurity. This is easily my favorite of the Hitchcock movies we've done, which is now three.
Yeah, Rear Window, Psycho, and North by Northwest.
Now, for a movie I hadn't seen yet, and for one that was older, and so I kind of had lower expectations or what, I don't know, whatever I came into this with. Loved it. I really like this movie, like a lot. I think it's great. And you can recognize about 100 other movies trapped in it that have all been made since.
Yeah.
Even off the top of my head, I can think of like Enemy of the State or anything where there's like a big underbelly conspiracy thing going on and the main character doesn't have any idea why they're involved in it. And suddenly they're wrapped up in it. And there's lots of flavors of this and lots of different turns and twists that the different movies have taken. But they all kind of owe something to this. And its pacing and its style and the kind of movie it is. And I really liked it. Like, top tier stuff here. Belongs on the list is what I'm saying.
It's the 14th movie we've watched in the Current Geek Film Fest. So it is the second favorite of yours out of those 14 is what you're saying.
Yeah, I think Schindler's List edges it out.
Sure.
If you said to me though, hey, what if we got more sort of put things in more genres? Like if we split these movies into kind of their little special rows that they belong into, you know, historical this or comedy that or whatever. This is ahead in most categories. And again, surprisingly so, I'm not really a, you know, old 50s movie guy. It's not really my jam.
We've watched a lot of 50s movies. The decade that is most represented in the movies we've watched is the 50s.
Sure. The 50s was the, golden age, or is that supposed to be the
40s? The golden age of cinema.
It's also our first Cary.
There's debates about which one is the golden age. But we've seen Sunset Boulevard from 1950, Rear Window from 1954, Singing in the Rain, 1952, All About Eve, 1950, and now North by Northwest, 1959. That's five of the 14 from the 50s.
Yeah, that's a pretty good showing. And the fact that Hitchcock shows up so much, I'm sure he shows up again, right? This can't be his only.
I don't think so.
Is this it? This fall?
Just when he's getting on the bus at the beginning.
No. I mean, we're not done with his movies, are we, in this list?
Oh, you mean in the list.
Yeah, in the list. Not him, not the cameo, but the list.
I'm trying to play it off now like I knew what you were talking about. I was joking. I honestly thought you meant like he showed up.
I kind of like that too, though. I like your interpretation. Yeah.
We will not have another Hitchcock movie for quite a while. There are others in the list, but I'm scrolling way down here.
Yeah.
And still not seeing one.
Gotta be like, I'm just gonna guess here. Hold on. It's gotta be
Gosh, I think it's till we get to 48.
It's like the birds or something. No? Because we've done Psycho. I can't think of what it would be, but I'm sure he's in there again. The guy's a genius.
Yeah.
That's what you do with genius.
I'm pretty sure the third man. Wait, not third man. That's not Hitchcock. I mean, what's that? Now I can't remember the name of it.
The third man.
Third man instead.
I don't know. I did. That reminds me. I watched the Orson Welles documentary. I told you about this a little bit on another show yesterday, but I just wanted to throw this out before I forget about it, and then we can move on because it's got nothing to do with today's movie. But on Netflix right now is a movie called 39 landed.
Steps. That's what I was
39
saying.
Steps. All right. Just landed on Netflix called They'll Love Me When I'm Dead. A quote, some say, unappropriately assumed that Orson Welles said it. But anyway, as a guy who's sort of got his hand in a lot of stuff we talk about here on this this film festival portion of Current Geek, that is absolutely worth your time to watch. You should check it out. It is a really interesting view into the mind of Welles, into the latter part of his career, the movie he got that should have been his greatest film that he never finished, the people around it. It's fascinating, and I really enjoyed it. So you should all watch that. But not and that's not in this. That's not part of this.
Well, I was going to ask, do you think you would have been as interested in watching it and or have enjoyed it as much if we weren't doing this little project of watching a classic movie every month?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, I think I still may have been intrigued by it if I had to run into it by accident.
Mm-hmm.
But this was the kind of thing where I'm flipping through, looking for new stuff or good documentaries in general, and I see this, and I go, ooh, Orson Welles, hey. We just had a mouthful of that guy. Like that didn't sound right, did it? But we just talked about that guy a lot, and I feel like we will
bite no Orson Welles before it's time.
I feel like because we do what we're doing here. Anytime this stuff crops up, like something about Hitchcock or something about I don't know some actor that you know we don't talk about anymore or whatever, but that you and I specifically saw. Yeah, I totally get this new interest in this stuff. Way more than
one of the reasons I wanted to do this, because I know some people whine a little bit that, you know, well, it's not really a geeky thing to watch great movies, but I want to bring the geek to the thing.
Right.
You know, we can get in an echo chamber if we're always just like, we must only view and consume geeky things. Like, let's bring the geek into the movie and let's see. Let's learn and expand our horizons and soak up the stuff. Imagine how much drabber World of Warcraft would be if you didn't get any of the references. If you'd never seen Lord of the Rings or, you know, you never got any of the puns, right? So this is that for the wider world. It's like you're going to see things after you watch these movies and go, oh, that's what that means. Oh, that's what they're talking about.
Yeah, it's weird how much that stuff sticks out in our own little walled geek culture now. I'll now understand a reference that was probably on Futurama and I didn't recognize it as something from North by Northwest because I don't, you know, I hadn't had the experience of seeing it. And it's not only that, it's just that you get to be a geek in a different time. It's like, what was, you know, go to 59, you're an average aged somebody, and what are you into, and is this representative of something you'd be super into or not? Were you following Hitchcock's career at that time? Would you be called a geek today? Yeah, or Cary Grant. Would you be called a geek today for the kind of love you had for what was emerging there? And then just the reverence I have for the stuff that precedes a lot of what I do like now, you know, that influences what I like now. So totally with you on that, 100%. And it's good.
Yeah, and North by Northwest particularly is the Hitchcockiest of the Hitchcock movies. I go back and forth in my own mind, and it depends what time of day and what mood I'm in, whether I like Rear Window or North by Northwest better.
Yeah.
I understand that Psycho is probably the better movie,
right,
but I don't like it as much, right? That's more of an object that I appreciate. Mm-hmm. Whereas Rear Window, I enjoy. North by Northwest, I enjoy. And they're enjoyable for me for different reasons. Rear Window is Jimmy Stewart, Cary Grant is North by Northwest, and North by Northwest is action and witty barbs, and Rear Window is that slow drawling humor. And the plot is that way, right? He never actually leaves his apartment. Whereas North by Northwest, he covers the width and breadth of the United States, right? Mm-hmm. They're so different. It's hard to compare them. And the one advantage I will give North by Northwest is it has everything you love about Hitchcock in it, because Ernest Lehman, who wrote it, said when he wrote it, I'm going to make the ultimate Hitchcock film. I'm going to write the film that has everything you do in it. And so if you've learned anything about Hitchcock ever, and like I said, we never pretend to be like a film scholarly show here, but everybody knows a few things about Hitchcock. One of them being the MacGuffin, right? There's always a thing they're chasing mm-hmm. that is irrelevant to the plot. And Cary Grant himself is the MacGuffin here to a certain extent, right? There's also the microfilm that they're after as well. That's the true MacGuffin. But in a sense, like the character that Cary Grant is mistaken for, right?
Yeah.
Is a MacGuffin because he doesn't exist.
Yeah, he's not there at all. And I thought when it started, I thought, oh, this is a movie about a guy who doesn't remember that he is somebody else, or at the end it's going to turn and he's going to finally admit, well, yeah, I am this guy. Okay, I admit it. Because it seems like way too many people were in on the trick and that he's the only one that isn't. And so I really was fascinated about where they'd go, because I know all the tropey endings to those kinds of stories because I've seen a million of them since, but I didn't know where this was going to go that way. And I'm pleasantly surprised it didn't go any of those directions. You know, when it went its own way, and it was fascinating. And also, I never really thought of myself as like a guy who appreciated Cary Grant very much, because again, out of time, out of place, not really my time.
But I don't understand why.
He's so great in this. Like, I think he's a huge part of what I liked about it. And it also, like you said, you alluded to the idea that it wasn't afraid to be funny and to laugh at itself and to let him do the stuff that he was famous for doing. And he got a chance to do those things, and he's just utterly charming and ridiculously watchable. And I 100% can see why this guy was like the, you know, top tier thing in the 50s and 60s. Like, Cary Grant was the man, and you followed him, and he was awesome, and he was great. And I went on a deep dive on Cary Grant like crazy. Died in 87. But he was older, 80 something, so he lived a nice long life.
Yeah, he lived a good long life.
Yeah. Just as tan then as he was in these movies, and always a handsome old dude and just a cool guy and an interesting family. His daughter still does a bunch of stuff. She talks about him today, and he just comes from a very specific time in Hollywood that I never had much, I don't know, time, respect, or whatever you want to call it for. And this flipped that for me. I just think he's magnetic in this role, and I really,
you know,
like,
funny. I was in the play Arsenic and Old Lace when I was in high school.
Yeah.
And because of that, I wanted to get the movie, and watch it, which stars Cary Grant. That is what set me down the Cary Grant rabbit hole. And I just started watching everything I could get my hands on with Cary Grant. And it's always been a bit of a struggle, because Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart were contemporaries, and they were very different types of characters, but they kind of fought for the same roles. And Philadelphia Story is great because they're both in it. I've always struggled on which one of them I like, and I think that's part of the reason why I go back and forth on Rear Window and North by Northwest, because Jimmy Stewart is the friendly guy, he's the pal, whereas Cary Grant's he's a little sharp witted, but he's also good-hearted, and they're just iconic lead male characters of their era.
Yeah, and they fit just about every movie you had one of those two archetypes. You got your guy for that, and it's usually Cary Grant.
By Northwest is the Cary Grant vehicle, right?
Yeah, like, yeah, totally.
He gets to be on the run. He gets to make his sharp barbs, but he also has a beautiful love interest that he has to save, and just everything you need in a Cary Grant role. It's right there.
I really, really also liked Eva Marie Saint in this, who I was already a fan of in a more modern sense, because she keeps popping up in things. She's in her 90s and shows up in as a voice actor in some cartoon, and then as somebody's mm-hmm. grandmother in some small holiday special or whatever. She has worked consistently since those days and continues to this day.
Katara in Legend of Korra, if anybody is familiar.
Which is a big deal. Yeah, I mean, that's a big deal. She was in Superman Returns.
She was Martha Kent in Superman Returns.
There you go, with Brandon Routh, exactly.
Yeah.
And she was excellent in that role. She's always been consistently good, and I think she is a knockout and in her prime here and just beautiful. And this is acting. One of the reasons I at least say that I don't like 1950s, 40s, 50s, and early 60s acting is I always felt like female roles were either told to or it was expected to or something. They were always supposed to be constantly in peril, always screaming and hiding behind a man, always sort of overacting and sort of stage acting in every scene. It just always felt that way to me. And I just felt like there, mm-hmm. there were no female roles where somebody really jumped out and made it their own and was nuanced
rare.
It was rare. I feel like she's that. I feel like she is that in a time where it's rare to be that. She was that different kind of actress. And I think
she was given a different kind of role too here. Right.
Right.
Like this is not part of it is a very classic femme fatale role. Right. She's going to leave. She's going to use her womanly wiles to fool Roger Thornhill. But she's also a spy.
Right.
And she also is on the run. And I don't want to, you know, it is of its era. And there are parts where it's like, oh, come on. She could have got herself out of that situation. She right. didn't need him to help.
Right.
Like that still happens. But for, you know, by comparison, it's a much stronger character than you usually got in these kind of.
Yeah. Movies. The moment to moment stuff with her is just I felt more meaningful. I totally bought into just everything she was saying and portraying. And I think that she's just a real asset to the thing. And it struck me too. And I don't know. I didn't go to see if she was actually doing any of this, but it seems like she'd be great in something like a James Bond film, like a really good James Bond. I hate to call them Bond girls, but that's what people call them. But, you know, a smart nemesis style character to James Bond would be very interesting. But she has a huge career with tons of stuff, and I could go for days just digging through it and finding it all. And I think she's fascinating, just very interesting.
Yeah.
And to see her just still kicking it and rocking it today and working and is so cool. I think that's great.
And it's funny too, because she sort of, I don't want to say she slipped off the radar, but this was definitely her biggest role of the time. Right.
Right.
Like you don't see her in a lot of other big roles throughout history, and I think that may be for the best.
Yeah.
Right, that may have helped her, because I'm gonna go back here and find out how dumb what I just said was, but after North by Northwest, she does Exodus, which was like a blockbuster.
Yeah.
All Fall Down, 36 Hours, some TV movies, the Russians are coming, like it is sort of the pinnacle.
Yeah.
And then she goes in the 70s into How the West Was Won.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's TV movie, TV series after that. She kept working, whereas I think some other people after Exodus might have just like retired into Norma Desmond territory, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, and escaped into their house. And Eva Marie Saint was like, well, no, I still want jobs. I still want to work. So even though the big movies don't come in large amounts after 62, there's never more than a couple years between her appearing in something.
Yeah. Just always kind of around. And I think it's impressive. And our bad guy here, James Mason,
avoided being on the Love Boat.
Oh, no,
I'm wrong. She was on two episodes of the Love Boat.
You couldn't avoid it then.
Yeah. That's a hard one to get around.
Yeah. I mean, dude, if podcasting existed in the 70s, you and I would have to go on Love Boat at some point. Just that's how the way that was. You had to be minor to semi, almost major Hollywood star and everybody in between. And you all ended up parading through that damn show.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
That's pretty much how it worked. But we got our bad guy, James Mason. I always like his face. Something about that guy's face that is always interesting to me. There's some trivia story here that shortly after this finished filming, he suffered a major heart attack. He didn't die. Ended up living through 84 and died at age 75.
So not everybody in this movie is dead.
No. Oh, I mean, Eva Marie Saint is still here.
Yeah.
I mean, she's walking.
She's in every scene alone.
She's walking around talking to nobody. That's totally, that's true. And I, you know what? It's funny. Maybe she anchored it to the point that I didn't even think about it in this movie. And I usually do.
Really?
Didn't even think about it. I was like, oh, I miss Cary Grant. It'd be cool if that guy was around to sell stories or whatever. And, you know, that kind of stuff. But I didn't think about Martin Landau being dead, which is true also. And
only recently, like, he was in Entourage.
Yeah. He's just barely dead. Not barely. Yeah. But last fresh few dead. Years. Yeah. As fresh, fresh death. Is that what they say? I feel like they shouldn't say that.
I realized I was quoting something that no one has seen.
Yeah.
Which was an episode of Subbrilliant Television we did on Austin Cable Access in the 90s.
Yeah. Well, he's a cool, this James Mason guy, cool guy. And I guarantee in the chat room, if any of you have never, you're like, I don't know who James Mason is. You've seen him. You'll look at that face and go, oh, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Okay. The Verdict. And he's super old in that. He's in that Lolita movie. Actually, I never saw that, but Star is Born, like a million huge things. And then later in life did, you know, other stuff. Ivanhoe and The Search for Alexander the Great, and narrated a bunch of stuff. He's a really interesting dude. I remember this miniseries about Jesus in 77. My mom was real big on it. It was called Jesus of Nazareth, and he was Joseph of Arimathea. He was Jesus's earth dad. In that thing,
James Mason. Wow. Yeah, because he usually did play, if not villains, kind of shady characters.
Yeah, almost always somebody a little bit shady, a little bit dark, you know, something. Yeah, but he's great in this.
What are we trying to say about Joseph?
It's no kidding. It's kind of a weird casting, but I don't know. In his day, he was probably like, who gets cast like that now? Like, I can't think of any names, but yeah.
Well, Roddy McDowell used to be that guy.
Yeah, yeah. Even now, even he still does that stuff. He'll still end up being villainous in almost
Kingsley,
everything.
Kingsley?
Ben Kingsley maybe is a good example. Can do some lovable, nice roles, but also gets
because not always villain,
yeah,
but often kind of on the
edge. Oh, like Snape. my brain.
Also fresh dead.
Who just fresh dead, yeah. Anyway, him, he did that a lot. You know, he was very versatile, could do tons of different things, but you would often see him as the Sheriff of Nottingham and as Snape and as
Alan Rickman. Thank you.
The FBI.
Even in Love Actually, Alan Rickman's character is a little bit sleazy.
A little bit, yeah. Oh, that's a great movie. I got to get that ready for the holidays.
Yeah, and Die Hard.
Exactly. But that's kind of who James Mason was, I think, for his time. He's never going to be your handsome leading man. He's going to be your weirdly handsome kind of evil guy who everybody's, you know, out to stop or whatever. And he's great in this. I thought he was great. I think they're all suitably weird and shady. Like, the entire cabal of, like, him and all his henchmen and everything are just shady enough that
Martin Landau is often a lovable character in other places, or maybe a curmudgeon, maybe, but he's like straight up scary evil. Like, he's eviler. James Mason at least has some politeness, right? He has a facade of, well, I wish I didn't have to kill you. Whereas Martin Landau's like, no, please, can I kill someone now? It's, you know, I really want to kill someone.
Yeah, he was dead set on doing it. In fact, up to the very end, he's got his foot on his hand on the cliff. And by the way, I should have mentioned, this movie features an entire end sequence of trying to escape and fighting on top of Mount Rushmore, which
Hitchcock just wanted to do. That was Ernest Lehman wrote the story to fit Hitchcock.
Yeah.
And one of the things Hitchcock had always wanted to do was a chase scene on Mount Rushmore. And this was it. He realized his dream.
It's so good. It's like, I don't know how to explain this. What I expected was crappy set recreation. And instead, there's a lot of actual footage and a lot of actual stuff happening there. Now, there's some close-up shots where I don't think they're actually on the rocks up there. They're not right under Washington's nose for some dialogue, so they can fake around that stuff pretty well. But the feeling that you're there, that
they
this is Mount.
They went and shot in the park.
Yeah, and you can tell. And for a movie that old, which otherwise has some pretty cheeseball set stuff in it, like, there are some scenes out in the woods that look like, you know, an interior shot from an old Star Trek episode where they're clearly in a studio that's like carpet floor fakery, like the trees aren't real. Like, there's a lot of that going on. But even
it did have some of the trees reminded me of cell phone towers. I'm not gonna lie a little bit.
But I enjoy, my stupid voice is going, I enjoy that stuff in its own way. Like, I kind of miss, I'm, how do I put this? When I was a kid and I'd see something on Saturday afternoon on television that was just on, and it was something from my mom or even my grandmother's era, I remember it was always kind of magical. It's like, oh, wow, weird. It's black and white. Or, oh, look at that.
Yeah, it's different.
Matte paintings. Or how come the lizards are stop? You know, I didn't know what stop motion was, but the way they move is so weird. And I miss having that feeling of wonderment that must have always been there for those who saw these when they first were coming out. You know, when movies discovered, when talkies happened or...
Yeah, yeah. Like, how did they do that? How did they create a forest like that?
Right. And that's
amazing.
I try to put myself in that mindset when you and I are doing these. I think I'm actually getting better at it because I am approaching it in a more, not childlike way, but just kind of a, hey, this is a first experience and I want to be able to feel this the way it's supposed to feel. And I just bought into the milieu of everyone wears suits in 59.
They do.
Yeah,
that's just real.
That was just real. And
some of the most fascinating parts of this were the actual on location scenes in New York, where I was like, "Ooh, look, that's real New York. That's 1959 New York, right there."
Yeah. Oh, he's mean to people waiting for cabs. Can I just point that out real quick?
Yeah.
My gosh, it was like 2-3 cabs in a row.
That would never happen with Uber.
No. That's all I could think about was like, how different would this be now? I wouldn't hate a North by Northwest remake. There may have been one and I didn't look, but I wouldn't turn one down. I think this is
one of the ones where if you're against a remake, you're against it on principle, right? This is such a great movie. You shouldn't try. But I think you could do this story.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, could you do it as well as Hitchcock? And that's a tall, tall order. I don't know who would be able to try this. But when I was watching it, I was thinking this story still holds up despite the fact that they're taking cabs and flying TWA and still smoking everywhere. And, you know, they have to use telephones, to call ahead. I was like, in fact, some ways the story would work better because you can automate so much of your life with apps and things and fake a person so much better than you could back then. That I would actually be interested to see someone update this story. What's his name? George? The fake persona.
Right.
George Kaplan.
There you go. George Kaplan.
I want to see the modern day methods that George Kaplan is faked with.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Eva Marie Saint, her character for the time. That character was very forward. Eve Kendall is like, whoa, hold on, hottie. Really? You can talk like that on the train?
Yeah.
I mean, those scenes would hold up, would be just as sexy today as they were back then. And in fact, I wouldn't even change them. Mm-hmm. The dripping innuendo is what makes them so interesting, what makes them work. So, the wrong director probably blows this.
Yeah.
But I think it could be done, and I think it would be interesting to see it done. And maybe you don't do Mount Rushmore.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe that. Let's play with that idea for a moment. Where could you do the final scene that would be as iconic and interesting but modern, and get away from the comparison, right? Because if you do the end scene in Mount Rushmore, it's like, wow, you really are just ripping off Hitchcock, aren't you?
Yeah.
Like, could you do? Is there some other modern situation that you could have the chase scene happen in, like Burning Man, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Or I don't know, like, what's, because Mount Rushmore was new, it was a new technological achievement still in a certain way.
And yeah, I mean, I
wonder if there's some equivalent of that we could come up with.
Well, there's a trick that's been done a little bit over time. Like, there's a, I forget the name of it, but there's a Brian De Palma movie that's a lot like a Hitchcock movie, and you'd never, if you didn't know about the original, you wouldn't know it was a remake is maybe a strong word, but something very much inspired by it or whatever. Like, you'll see a modern version of Othello play out in some new movie and know it's Othello unless someone says sure.
Yeah.
So it's possible maybe that Hitchcock is just, you don't want to approach his work too lightly, and it's scary. Even Gus Van Sant was so scared to remake Psycho that he literally remade Psycho, like scene for scene, moment for moment.
I think North by Northwest should not be seen for scenery.
Absolutely not. I think that was a mistake with Psycho even, because it's just too careful. And but you also don't want to go too crazy, or then the purists are going to be like, well, wait a minute, I'm not going to see your dumb movie because you've ruined this masterpiece.
I think you could do the plane scene, yeah. And it would be even cooler because instead of just a crop duster, it would be like Harrison Ford, is out or flying his biplane around. And like, wait a minute, that's not Harrison Ford. He's dive bombing me.
Yeah, that. I forgot about that whole scene. That whole scene is so harrowing and well done for 1959. When he's running toward the camera, it's kind of a tracking shot. He's being chased by that airplane behind him. That is something else, man. It's really well done.
Oh yeah, no, that is the scene. Right? Yeah, like that is amazing.
And now it's quiet.
That was just a local crop duster in Bakersfield.
Yeah,
or maybe not Bakersfield, but somewhere around there.
They weren't afraid to not have music for much of that. They weren't afraid to just have strange pacing of like, is he really coming at me? Is that seriously happening right now? Oh my gosh, it is coming at me. I'm going to have to hit the dirt in my freaking suit. He does it. He gets up, realizes, well, it's got to go around. Where can I go? What can I do? Oh, it's shooting now. There's bullets coming out of that thing. Somebody's got a gun up there. Okay, this is getting worse. The whole thing with the guy at the bus is freaky. Like, that whole sequence feels like modern auteur filmmaking to me and not some 1950s thing. Like, that really... really held up and was super strong, I thought.
Yeah, that was supposed to take place in northern Indiana, but it was shot on location in the towns of Wasco and Delano, north of Bakersfield, California.
Yeah, that looked like...
What's funny is I always thought, like, huh, I wonder what part of Indiana that is when I was a kid watching it. And now when I look at it, I'm like, oh, that is clearly Bakersfield because I've been to Bakersfield. You know, like, yes, I have driven on that road, I think. Yeah. Like, I've driven on roads exactly like that road.
Yeah, it was cool. I bought into what that was supposed to be and where it was and everything.
Also, the scene in the UN is interesting because they were denied permission to film there.
Well, I can't imagine why.
So they had Cary Grant pull up in a taxi cab across the street with a hidden camera crew to get the film of him getting out of the cab and walking across the plaza.
Oh, I was going to say, I mean, they did the... So that's just him being being a civilian, but then sneakily filming it, basically.
Yeah. So, and they didn't get releases, I bet, from any of those people.
No. I mean, could they have done anything? I guess they could have after the
fact.
That
was before that kind of thing really was common. So, they probably just risked it.
Also, this idea.
It's far enough away. Nobody's going
to
care.
This idea you can just walk into the UN, talk to a receptionist, go hang out in a big...
Yes, I would like to see...
Yeah, like... Imagine the that today. General, like, okay, yeah, can I please talk to the Secretary General? Your name, please. Like, no, you're not doing any of that. There's like major guards and metal detectors, and like it's a whole different world now. But it's fun to see that kind of quaintness of.
And I imagine it probably wasn't that easy even back then. But yeah,
sure. That scene where he gets the knife in his back is pretty typical 50s Hollywood shocky moment.
Oh, that's a Hitchcock. That's a Hitchcock trope.
Oh, big
Hitchcock
time.
Invented that move. Yeah,
pretty much. I wanted to scream, though, because when he's fallen down and Cary Grant's holding his body, immediately grabs the handle of the knife.
I know.
It's like, dude, what are you doing?
All over it, man. Come on.
What are you doing? Don't hold the knife, you big idiot.
Also, you don't remove a knife in a wound like that. That's bad. That's bad first aid.
Right. He'll die. He could bleed out. And your job is to
stabilize him until the emergency personnel get there.
Slow his fall. That's fine. We don't have a problem with that.
That's fine.
Lay him down softly, gently. That's
carefully.
Cool. But don't
protect
go
the neck.
Don't go shink and then look at it and go, I didn't do it. I had nothing to do with it.
Like,
see?
Pose for the camera.
Oh my gosh.
This is me with the knife.
That whole bit was just like, come on, you guys. What are you doing over here? But I guess it was fine.
Now, one thing we should mention, this is based on a story by journalist Otis C. Guernsey, about a U.S. traveling salesman who travels to the Middle East and is mistaken for a fictitious agent, becoming saddled with a romantic and dangerous identity. Now, the idea of mistaken identity was taken from some actual news stories that Guernsey had reported on. The story of the traveling salesman with the mistaken identity was fictionalized. They paid him $10,000.
Oh my gosh.
Which, a lot of money back then, but still.
Yeah.
They paid him $10,000 for that story and they didn't use it. They just used the concept around that.
Wow. Yeah, $10,000, that's probably like, I don't know what the growth rate on that is, but that's probably $80,000 or $90,000 or $100,000 today or something. I don't know.
I'll go look it up.
Yeah.
$10,000, 1959.
There's probably a way to find out what that is. That's really curious to me for some reason. I just want to know what you throw away in modern money when you have to pay somebody for their idea and then not use it. It's got to be.
And I wonder how often they would do that. Like, they've gotten careful, more careful about that. Mm-hmm. That's about $85,000 okay. today.
So kind of up ish.
So it's not nothing. That's a lot of money.
No, it's definitely not nothing.
Movies these days make $50 to $100 million if they're Hitchcock level,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So $85,000, that ain't much. I want points on the back end. That's what I want.
Yeah, exactly. That is that's super interesting. I don't know. You always hear all the stories about in old Hollywood somebody's idea getting taken and not getting credit for it or not getting paid for it or
right.
whatever. This is the new one by me. They actually
paid. At a certain point, they got very careful about that because they didn't want the dogs of hell barking.
Oh, right. The hounds of the hellhounds. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember that scene. That was a great scene. So a piece of trivia that I read that kind of cracked me up was according to some people on the set, including I can't find her name now, who I was just talking about, the three names. Anyway, my brain's like half on today. Eva Marie Saint. She says, and others say, that on set, when people would come up for during breaks or whatever to get autographs from the crew, Cary Grant would only do autographs for 15 cents a piece. And now I don't know what 15 cents is today, but I doubt that's very much. It's not like 30 or 40 bucks. It's probably like, I don't know, a couple bucks or something. But yeah, he wouldn't do it unless you had 15 cents. Kind of bummed me out a little bit, you know? Just come on,
Cary. $1.28.
$1.28. See, that's not worth it. It's almost like it's an artificial barrier to make sure that, I don't know why you'd do it. It's just don't do that. Be nice and give people, sign things for people in there.
That's a hard one to tell. And maybe I'm just trying to rationalize because I like Cary Grant, but there is a point where Hollywood goes from being like, it's a scale issue, right?
Yeah.
Suddenly it's like, man, I would love to sign everybody's thing, but then that's all I would do.
Right.
And the way that's held today is handlers are the bad guy and say, I'm sorry, Mr. Grant has to go. Oh, I would love to sign more. I'm so sorry. I'm out of here.
Right.
Back then, they still hadn't figured out all the ways of doing that. So it might have been a very sensible idea at the time to say like, well, I don't have time to sign them all. So I can limit the amount we sign by charging something.
Yeah. It's like the time Star Trek's Q, John DeLancey, I approached to get a photo autographed, and because I was only had 29 of the $30 in cash required for such a transaction,
yeah,
he wouldn't do it. He was like, sorry.
Was he at a convention where he was sitting at a table?
Nope, he was walking around. It was a convention. It was in Vegas at a Trek convention. It was Star Trek stuff to be in,
but it
particular.
Wasn't I was wondering if it was that like a,
oh, you know, where you're lined up. Yeah. Yeah.
Sort of situation.
It wasn't like that where I was like holding up a line for a dollar or anything like that. It was a little chat we had. I shook his hand. This is a famous story on TMS, but his hand felt like an old volcanic rock for some reason. Just an
pumice.
Odd. Yeah. Like a pumice hand. And I complimented him on his work because at the time it was a little closer to it, but I complimented him on his work on Breaking Bad. And said how much I loved that and was wondering if I was a dollar short, would that still be okay? And he goes, oh, I'm sorry, it's not. But it shook his hand. Well, there you go. Mm. Mm-hmm. Q, what are you going to do? He's part of the continuum.
It's one of those things, too, again, and I actually have great respect for people like Lou Ferrigno who are like, I just don't do autographs unless it's at a table.
Right.
Where you pay for it. And maybe not so much Lou Ferrigno anymore, but at one time, if he starts doing it for one person, then it causes a cascade.
Right.
And suddenly there's a problem. There's a traffic problem. He can't get anything done. Like, I do respect people who are like, no, this will really cause an issue. I know it's just you asking, but I have to deal with the thousand of you
who are just asking. Yeah.
But if no one else is around and he got the 29 and he can play it off like it's 30, like, I don't know. I guess at a certain point he's like, yeah, but if I do that for you, then I'm going to be ended up doing it for everybody.
Yeah.
It gets around.
And the way I looked at it, I mean, I didn't how do I put this? It's not like I don't, like, suddenly, oh, I can't stand John Delancey. I hope I never see him again. It wasn't like one of those deals, but it did make me just kind of go, oh, all right, well, I get it. I get why you're doing it. I totally get it. But it, I don't know. At some point,
celebrities,
we're just
they're just like us.
Yeah.
Greedy.
Greedy and kind of a pain in the butt. Yeah. At the end of the
just
day.
Just like us.
Yeah. Careful who your heroes are or whatever the phrase is.
Never meet your heroes.
Or that's what it is. Never eat meat with your heroes. That's
never
what
eat
it is.
Your heroes.
Right. Never eat.
They'll never taste as good as you imagine.
they're always a little gamey, has been my experience.
Yeah. It's from all those conventions.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, I do have one question. North by Northwest.
Ah.
What is that? Okay, it's going to be dumb because it's going to be something to do with the where they end up in Dakota, or where do they, South Dakota. It's gonna end up be something to do with that. But North by Northwest, I don't understand the reference. What's the point of the directions?
Because it's not a real thing.
Okay.
And it's not quite known exactly how the name, I'm trying to find, the film's title is reported to have been the influence for the name of South by Southwest Music Festival.
Yeah.
That's not where the name part comes from. Shoot, I can't find it right now. I wish I had written this down more, but basically, there's a few different stories about how the name came about.
Yeah.
It's Northwest by North would be how you would say, where the direction, right. Like if you're a navigator. So this is backwards. It's not a normal usage.
Hmm.
And
does that have a double meaning? Like, hey, that's really weird. You'd never say that. Oh, that's 'cause this movie's weird and this guy isn't who he thinks he is. And, like, is that the point of it?
There is no such thing as North by Northwest on the compass. Northwest by North is one of the 32 points.
Yeah.
Lehman, the writer, says he used a working title for the film of In a Northwesterly Direction because the action was to begin in New York and end in Alaska.
Okay.
Which they ended up changing. But
right.
Then the head of the story department at MGM suggested North by Northwest, but that was still a working title. Other titles were included. Considered, including The Man on Lincoln's Nose, but they kept North by Northwest because, according to Lehman, we never found a better title. and the Northwest Airlines reference in the film plays on the title that he flies at Northwest, so he's going north on Northwest, but that's sort of retrofitting it in because that was just the working title. So yeah, it's kind of an accidental title.
Yeah, and it ends up being kind of non-sequential anyway. Or consequential, because once you've branded your movie and it becomes the thing it's going to become and has the impact it's going to have, then the name is just synonymous with whatever the thing is. Psycho is also a dumb name, by the way. It's a totally dumb name. It doesn't really explain much other than it's a, you know, psycho, and it makes you think, oh, crazy, okay. But it's not really a great name. But now we associate it with this classic film and it'll never go away. And it's a guy talking to his dead mom and, you know, like, it's connected forever with that. Star Wars, terrible name. The dumbest name. We have to come to grips with how stupid Star Wars is as a title. It's a dumb name. People get all caught up.
It's a generic name.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't tell you anything about the movie. Like, it's hard for you to get it past the fact that, no, but it's Star Wars. It's like, no, Star Wars means something because it became
because of what it was, it means something very important and powerful. Yeah. Like, it really matters. So people get all wound up and arguing about whether Phantom Menace or Empire Strikes Back or any of these subtitles are good or not when they get announced. And I'm always laughing at that going, y'all are just fine with Star Wars still. And you're arguing about
which
the
doesn't
subtitles.
Even describe. There are very few wars happening.
Right. Yeah,
there's
only
one war. Yeah. Not wars. One. Yeah. And you only see a couple of battles.
Yeah. And it's in the stars.
Guess it's in the stars. That part at least is accurate.
Yeah. But this is titling across the board. This is branding across the board. Apple means nothing without what they
ESPN, are. ESPN, that's the other classic example.
Beatles. Right? Beatles are the Beatles. That's a terrible name for a band.
B-E-A-T. It's a pun.
Right.
The name The Beatles is a bad pun.
It's a bad pun. Even if it was just the insect, it's still bad.
Well, but I think it's worse that it's a pun. It's like, oh, it's just the insect. Then it's like any other name, like it's a name after a thing.
Right.
So, but then it's weird because it's like, well, beetles, those aren't very nice insects, but it's B-E-A-T.
Yeah.
Because they're part of the new beat.
Yeah. The titles I like are the ones that are most nonsense. Pink Floyd, Monty Python,
Toad the Wet Sprocket.
Toad the Wet Sprocket. These are great names because they mean nothing. They're just kind of a throw it out there because I think they know somehow in the heart of hearts that it's not going to matter. If your work is good, the name you apply to it will then gain the importance or the notoriety or the whatever. And if people like Current Geek, then they're going to like us for what we're doing, and the name will then resonate that. But otherwise, it's kind of a dumb name, like every other name of everything ever.
Yeah. And I remember when we started the show, you were like, do we call it that again? We've had two other shows, but...
Yeah.
And it's like, why not?
Sure. Tavern
Bar. We've sunk a lot of energy into that brand now.
We absolutely have. Someone in the chat says, Scott, this is one of Scott's hills. I shouldn't say I'm famous for this, but I'm known for dying on certain hills. Mm-hmm. And I love the philosophical discussions that can happen around stuff like, what does it even mean, or whatever. And this is one of those. Like, I think Ace Tig in the chat says, I'm still confused by Ace Detect.
Yeah, man. So tell me about it.
Keep being confused.
That's one that takes a lot of explaining. Mm-hmm. It's really not worth the effort to explain.
Yeah. No, for real.
Yeah.
If it, you know, there's guys like Jack Johnson, boring name. That's normally like the guy up the road. See if you can borrow Jack's tractor because we got to move that tree, Bill, or whatever. But because the guy's this famous musician, people go, ooh, Jack Johnson, ooh. You know, it's famous Italian singers. They don't mean anything until you hear them. And then you're like, oh. So that's all I'll say about it. My point that I was trying to make through this whole thing is I'm always fascinated by originations of names, how hard people try to get them and lock them in, and why they seem important to them. But at the end of the day, if your stuff is good that the name's on, it won't matter. Call it anything you want to be popular forever because the work, you know.
If people like the work.
Yeah. Companies are the same way.
Can I just go back to one question about the plot before we wrap up today?
Of course.
Philip Van Damme's people, the whole movie turns on the fact that they don't bother to check if the telegram for George Kaplan really went to Roger Thornhill.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, it's so sloppy. The guy walks through, go, telegram for George Kaplan. Yeah. And Cary Grant gets up and is like, I got to go make a phone call.
Right.
Like, and they're like, oh, that must be him. He stood up when the guy walked through saying telegram. And I know, like, he stops the telegram boy and asks him something. And the boy tells him, like, oh, you got to go over there. But they don't follow him to see if he picks up the telegram.
No.
Right?
Yeah. That's a plot hole.
That's how you make sure you got George Kaplan. Mm-hmm. They're just like, oh, wow, it must be him.
Yeah.
Who else would ever stand up when someone else's name was yelled for a telegram?
Yeah. If that was the standard, everybody all day would be taking credit for things they weren't doing. Like, it's a little bit plot holey for sure. Or lazy. It's a kind of a lazy, weird little connection. So totally get it. Totally with you there. But I think the overall work here stands up.
And, oh, yeah, absolutely.
Impressed me. I came away really liking it. And maybe it's just I'm just finally coming around to seeing why Hitchcock was seen as he was seen. Because up till now, it was, you know, it's older stuff. So I have an eye that's not appreciating things because it's older. Some of it's in black and white. That, in my mind, makes it, well, that's before they knew what they were doing. And, you know, I'm not giving him the credit that he clearly deserves. And this movie got me a lot closer to it for whatever reason. And it's maybe the most accessible, most mainstream of the movies I've seen.
It moves. He's done. I mean, and to a large extent that goes back to Lehman's script. Like, he makes sure that you're never in one place for very long.
Right. And, okay. Sorry. Back to your point about him standing up and that was enough. Unrelated things in the chat room has the exact right things to say. It says it was all a misunderstanding. Was this an episode of Three's Company? Like, that's the plot device Three's Company used episode. Somebody misunderstood a thing somebody did, and the entire plot shifted because of it.
Jack's moving out?
Yeah. Or you hear somebody.
Why wouldn't he tell us?
You hear somebody talking about peeling a potato in the kitchen, and they're sure that means they're having an affair. It's like, it's as old as dirt, that tactic. It's just that Three's Company turned that into their main thing. They figured out a way to take this one little tropey thing a lot of people do with their stories, and they made it every story, every time.
So if someone would like to create a trailer with the Three's Company theme playing, perfect, but scenes from North by Northwest, that'd be great.
I mean, we wouldn't turn it down.
No.
We wouldn't stop you from doing your good work if you did that. Our next month's movie is going to be It's a Wonderful Life. That's right. It's a Wonderful Life, starring James Franco.
Oh, Jimmy Stewart.
Jimmy Stewart's who I meant to say. Not James Franco. That'd be funny. It's coming.
Well, the money's not here, Scott.
It's also a perfect pick for December, obviously, because you get the whole
Christmas
angle.
Yeah, and that just happened by accident, but hey, pretty cool.
Very long time since I've seen it. Probably the most stereotyped holiday film ever made. Meaning people
I will say
the
last time I watched it was years ago, but it had been a lot long time between watchings that time. And I remember thinking, oh, this is better than I remember.
Mm. Yeah. I actually think I'm going to like it. Just cause it's been a while and I do like it generally. You know, there's the very sappy exterior to that movie, but there's also some kind of darkness to it that I like. And I don't know. I think it's going to be good. 1946 is the year. It's a Wonderful Life is the movie, and next month is our viewing of It's a Wonderful Life with James Stewart. Mary, Mary, that whole thing. You guys have been there. You know what's up. So that'll be good. Next week, our normal, not normal, our episode of normalness, our commentary episode will be here where we just talk about some hot news going on, the Mandalorian
news. Actually,
I
think next week, because we missed last week, next week's Private Benjamin.
Oh, we have to get back on the time track. Yeah, all this coughing people you hear me doing, that's why I missed last week. I was horribly ill last week. I'm still dealing with the aftermath of it, but yes, you're right. Tom's right. We're not going to jack that up. We're going to try to keep the schedule the way it was. So next week will be Pilot Day, Autopilot. It's going to be which one? Which pilot?
Private Benjamin.
Oh, right. There was a TV show called Private Benjamin based on the movie, right? Or a book, or maybe both.
So we're not talking about the movie. Right. We're talking about the TV series.
Yeah, so that'll be good. So we're going to be doing that next week. Not Goldie Hawn. Whoever it is, I don't remember. But we'll be fully educated on what happened in the pilot episode of Private Benjamin next week right here.
Lorna Patterson and Hal Williams star in the TV series.
If y'all at home are like, well, I'd love to come live once in a while. We hear you talk about this chat room and stuff. Well, hey, it's actually not hard. You just show up at 5 p.m. Mountain Time on Tuesday nights. That's when we do the show live, regardless of our subject stuff. That's every week at frogpants.tv, unless we tell you otherwise, but that's when we do it. So next week at frogpants.tv, you can watch us live. Hang out with us. We'd love to have you here. As a reminder, you can support this show with your own dollars over at patreon.com/currentgeek. A bunch of you have, and we really appreciate you, and we'd love it if more did. So if you are in the mood to throw a little scratch at the creators you love, that being us, we assume you do. If you don't like us at all, then I would recommend not doing this, but if you like us and you like what we're putting together, by gum, patreon.com/currentgeek is the place for you to go. Also a reminder, Legal Geek's got a new bit today. We're going to talk about Niantic, the Pokemon Go creator, how they've failed to dismiss a patent infringement lawsuit on geotagging patents. What does this mean for the popular app? We'll find out right after this. I'll stick around for Legal Geek, and thanks to him for waiting a week to get his stuff on here. And finally, Tom Merritt, anything else you want to mention before we go?
Yes, that Gallium audiobook read by Veronica Belmont is in the store. Whoa. Go check it out. Audible.com. Just search for Tom Merritt or search for Gallium or search for Veronica Belmont. Any of those three things ought to pull it up. Or you can just go to tomsnewbook.com. That'll take you right to the Amazon page where it's listed as well. It is a book about a woman who is a salvager in a mined out solar system who discovers a controversial thing from the mining company's past that they don't want her to reveal. Check it out. Gallium at audible.com.
Sounds fantastic. Go check that out, everybody. In the meantime, there's a lot of stuff happening this weekend. We hope you have a great Thanksgiving. If you're looking for good deals on nerdy stuff for the holidays, you can head on over to frogpants.com/store and have a whole bunch of discounts, deep discounts on some various packages, prints and otherwise. So do check that out as well. I think that's going to do it for us. A reminder, you can go to currentgeek.com for our website. Everything is there. Contact details, Twitter accounts, ways to contact us, all of it. It's going to do it for us, for me, for Tom, for the rest of you. We'll see you next time.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week, we review an ongoing lawsuit between Niantic, the maker of Pokemon Go, and a patent owner who owns a geotagging patent, and what the potential damages could be for this popular phone game. News broke a few weeks ago of Niantic exceeding $2 billion in revenue from their hit software app Pokemon Go. Later this week, the Nintendo Switch will have the first classic-style Pokemon game come out for that system, called Pokemon Let's Go Eevee and Pikachu, and these games are also configured to integrate with the phone app phenomenon. That could make Pokemon Go even more popular again. But all this financial success draws the risk of lawsuits, which is exactly what is happening in this Delaware case we cover today. Blackbird Tech LLC is the owner of U.S. patent number 9802127 on a video game including user-determined location information. The general gist of the claims in this patent are to cover a computer game or method where GPS signals are used to read a first physical location of a user and then display images of the first physical location on a user's device, along with virtual objects that are not physically present at the first physical location. In other words, the game displays a map or current image of the user's surroundings and adds virtual elements to it. This set of claims was clearly tailored to target covering augmented reality games. Blackbird's patent has an original filing date going back to 2011, but it issued in October last year. So in December, Blackbird sued Niantic and claimed Pokemon Go infringes the claims of their patent. Niantic decided to file a motion to dismiss in April, claiming that the patent was invalid under recent software patent rules stemming from a Supreme Court decision entitled Alice v. CLS Bank. The Alice decision makes software patents and business method patents invalid if they merely recite abstract ideas performed on generic computer equipment. This decision has led to a slew of patents being rejected or invalidated, as the abstract idea rules tend to be broadly applied. But here, the judge in a Delaware federal court ruled last week that Niantic oversimplified the claims of Blackbird's patent in arguing that they were covering just an abstract idea. The court noted that the system and method in the claims actually takes images of actual locations before integrating those images into the virtual video game environment, and that is allegedly more than just an abstract idea. Seems like a pretty close call to this patent attorney, but it was good enough to overcome a motion to dismiss. The result is that this case will continue through the discovery process unless the parties settle. Niantic's attempt to swat this case away quickly has failed, and a long, expensive fight in court will thus be ahead. Niantic may still prevail on a non-infringement or invalidity argument in the full trial, but it will take months of litigation work to determine those grounds. If Niantic loses this case, remedies such as money damages or an injunction to shut down the game may occur. It is far more likely that money damages would be awarded, but that could still seriously impact the future development of the popular phone app. The stakes are huge, and that explains why both parties are willing to fight this out so far in court. The bottom line is, in many fields like software, there are usually ongoing patent application families with relatively broad disclosures that can later become patents when they happen to cover later developments that become big money makers, like augmented reality games. It can be really hard to avoid these risks when you're a big success like Niantic, and it seems to be just an added cost of doing business under the current US IP regime. We will keep our eyes on this case and provide updates when available, but in the meantime, we can still enjoy catching those digital pocket monsters. Also, RIP to Stan Lee, who was blessed to live long enough to see his stories become a major hit film franchise and inspiration to so many people in our community and beyond. Excelsior. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network.
Frog Pants Network.
Get more shows like this at frogpants.com.